My life.
Amazing.
My life.
My life.
Amazing.
My life.
My life.
With
amazing.
My life.
Amazing strangers.
Hello and welcome to episode 7 of My Life with Amazing Strangers. I'm Gary Robinson. Today, I'm delighted to say I'm joined by one of my two regular co-hosts. It's Dr. Suzanne Zeedyke. No stranger to asking tough questions to spark our fierce curiosity, Suzanne, in this episode and future episodes, will be leading discussions that, as humans, we sometimes wish to avoid, however, nonetheless, are exceptionally important. And I'm honoured, to be honest, that Dr. Suzanne Zeedyke will be leading the thinking in this area of care over the next couple of weeks, months, hopefully into years, you never know. Today we discuss the impact of corporal punishment, but before Suzanne introduces our guests, we join the conversation as I ask Suzanne to explain more about fierce curiosity. Suzanne, it's wonderful to have you, not as a guest, for a change, or as an expert, as a co-host. This is all my broadcasting dreams come true, Suzanne. Honestly, I love it. How are you doing? So I can see you, because obviously we're on this fantastic thing called Zoom, but this is very much an audio production, so it's a podcast, but you're looking fantastic this evening.
It's lovely to be here. It's lovely to be doing this and to exploring these really edgy topics. Thank you.
As I said in the introduction, the podcast title is My Life with Amazing Strangers, which is exactly what it does. It says on the tin, I meet, you meet, David meets wonderful strangers. A lot of them end up being friends, but they've got fantastic stories to tell all around care. And that's what this series is about. It's about care. Where I love your contribution here, just to set this up, is that you'll bring something deeper to this from my point of view, because we can only talk about care in the here and now and the present day, but you have this wonderful, wonderful theme called fierce curiosity, which looks at not just care in the here and now, but also where care has come from and why we are where we are today. So you can describe it far much better, but for the listener, tell us a little bit more about fierce curiosity, what it is, where did it come from?
Fierce curiosity, for me, is needed when you have to get curious about something that you would really have preferred never to need to wonder about because it's uncomfortable. And so fierce curiosity is needed when you need to dig down deep and find the courage to get curious about that thing that is really uncomfortable. When we go back in time to look at the ways in which we used to care for children, we're sometimes quite shocked by what we see. And if we can get curious about how change came about because we don't do those things anymore, we can begin to see how change is made, and maybe we can get reflective about the ways in which we might be causing harm today, and that's harder to see. So that lets us dive in.
And we talk about children, don't we? But we all become adults. So it's what's happening in childhood now, in my childhood, in your childhood, in our guests' childhoods, to where we are now as adults, and how we're formed and how we think and how we behave and how we are sometimes traumatized as adults.
That's exactly why it's really important, one, to understand that the care we receive as children has an impact on how we grow up and the adults we become and the capacities we have, say, to have relationships or to manage our emotions. It really matters what we experience as children. And it's also important to be able to reflect on that in our time, in modern times, because very often it's hard to see and to hear that you're harming children, even though they would have thought the same in the past. They just did what was normal. So if we can understand what used to be normal in the past and we can now see as harmful, perhaps we'll get better at seeing in today's world what we currently do that harms. And that has an impact on how the children today grow up. So in other words, it's not just a history project. It's really looking at the history to try to be able to see ourselves better in our time.
So tell us a little bit about our guests today.
I am delighted that today we have with us Frankie Larkin and Emily LaRanja, who are going to help us to think about the edgy topic of corporal punishment in British schools. Emily is a nurture teacher at Lynburn Primary, and Frankie is a citizen of Scotland who, as a child, was treated in ways that he experienced as humiliating by teachers, and indeed, in which he was belted by a number of his teachers. If we can look at this edgy topic and how we don't do that anymore in Britain, we can think about how to make change for children. So let me welcome, please, Emily. It's lovely to have you here.
Hi, Suzanne. Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for having me here.
And Frankie, it is very good of you to come to tell us your story.
I am glad to be here. Looking forward to, just tell my story and listening to outcomes. Yeah, nice to be here.
Fantastic. Thank you both for being here. So what if we just dive in? Emily, you're a nurture teacher, as I said, at Lynburn Primary. Can you tell us, what does that mean? What does the nurture teacher do? What kinds of things might you help children with? Just give us a sense of what that means.
So nurturing practices involve looking at children in terms of their social and emotional development. It's really about understanding how children need to feel emotionally safe and physically safe within their environment to flourish, which involves developing positive and trusting relationships. So all behaviour is seen as communication. And when children experience distress, this will often come out through behaviour. So really equipping children with the language they need to express themselves is fundamental. So my role as a nurture teacher is to embed these principles and support the development of emotional literacy within children, really to try and increase their self-belief, their self-esteem through focusing on their strengths and giving them strategies to support regulation. And I should probably say that nurture doesn't necessarily happen in a nurture room or with a nurture teacher. It's really about embedding these principles throughout a school. So what we've tried to carve out at Lynburn is really a culture of nurture.
Emily, can you tell us how you do that? Just give us a couple of really practical ways that you find helps children with that emotional regulation.
The support we offer at Lynburn is tiered through universal support, additional support, and intense support. So it's really about the specific needs of each children. So we have developed a whole school model of support that benefits every single child at Lynburn on a daily basis. Every class at Lynburn has an ambassador, and we meet weekly. And we plan out wellbeing moments that they can deliver to their peers in class. So they learn about breathing techniques, they learn tapping, they learn self-holding, they learn all these things that children can be equipped with that will help to calm and soothe their nervous systems. So children are given 5 to 10 minutes every day by their teacher to deliver these sessions. We also have peer mediators who are timetabled throughout our school playgrounds who support peers to resolve like little arguments that they've had with their friends. We have a CAM club, which was the brainchild of one of the ambassadors who wanted to support regulation of peers within the playground. So universal support is very much led by the children, led by their leadership. So additional support involves looking at the environment within the school. So we have developed a classroom based upon the science of Dr. Bruce Perry, where children can move their bodies, for example, to help them to process tricky emotions that they might be experiencing.
And Emily, one of the favorite things of mine that you do in the school is that if children come into the nurture base, every single chair that they might choose, just a standard plastic chair, like lots of us are used to in schools, you have written on the back of every single chair a sentence like, I am loved. Today I am curious. I am worthwhile. Today I feel special. I can help my friends today. And you've just written that in a black marker. And you tell me that very often when the children come in, they choose a very favorite chair and it becomes their chair. Is that right?
Yes, I didn't actually pay attention to how much that really resonated with children until there was two care experienced boys there, and they weren't fighting over a chair, but they were wanting to sit in the same chair that said "I am loved." So when one child couldn't get that chair, they would find the one saying "I deserve love and belonging." So to me, that just showed how important those small messages, which aren't just in the back of chairs, they're on windows, they're on staircases, they're, you know, in every corridor and wall. We do try to give these affirmations to children and show them how loved they are.
That's a brilliant time to bring you in, Frankie, because this doesn't sound like the school you began primary school at in the early 1960s. Does it?
No, not by a long shot. I mean, listening to that, I would gladly go back to school just now. You know, and I think if I knew I was getting that kind of welcome at that age, then I probably wouldn't have been as anxious going to school, I have to say. Yeah. I suppose I'm really, really intrigued by the emotional work that you're doing, Emily, because that ties in with my early experience at school, before corporal punishment, before the belt, before physical abuse. I suppose my first experience of emotional abuse would be, I suppose it's better to tell you first that I had started nursery. My mum put me into a nursery. I think I must have been about four and a half. And she did that with good intention of bringing me out Michelle, because I didn't talk. I wasn't a talkative child. And there's always a joke made about that. She said, well, it was probably the worst thing I'd done, because you never shut up since it, you know. And then I started primary school not too long after that. And then my mum decided to move house, because it was a room and kitchen. There were six of us living in it, so we needed a bigger house. So we moved to a different catchment area. So I had to start a new school again. And I think the biggest trauma that I had was when I went into the class. My mum took me in, like all mums do, or dads, you know, when they're starting their first day. I couldn't stop crying. And the teacher very kindly sat me on top of her desk. So I felt a bit secure and a bit special at that. And then I watched my mum walk out the door, break my heart, crying too. So it was a mutual separation, which traumatised my mum as well. However, that didn't materialise very well soon after that. And I can't remember what the time scale was, but I got this other teacher. And in those days, you got the catechism. It was a Catholic school, so you had to read from the catechism every day, your prayers. So it was my turn to stand up and read something from the catechism. And I was so nervous that I stuttered quite a lot and I couldn't really read it properly. So I was rudely interrupted by a very harsh voice telling me to leave the room and go and help the janitor. So that was my very first experience of my, I don't know how long after it was my first day, but it wasn't too long after that. That was my first experience, emotional abuse. And that was an ongoing thing with that teacher. I would get sent to help the janitor.
So Frankie, can I give that back to you?
Yeah.
I hear you telling us the story of a little boy in the early sort of 1963, 1964 Scotland, who has had three moves, nursery, school, has had a house move, has had intense separation anxiety, because you must have been about four when you went into primary school.
Yeah.
And you had a experience of a teacher who helped a bit with that, but then a different teacher humiliated you and made you feel scared. So if we can all just pause and think for a moment about what that feels like for a four-year-old who can't read very well. Well, actually, that's not very surprising for a four-year-old, but Frankie, you get humiliated. And if we jump ahead for just a moment in your story, it turns out that you never really do learn to read very well throughout school, do you?
No.
In fact, how old are you when you learn to read, Frankie?
33. I could read certain things. I mean, I never read a newspaper. I never read a story, a children's story. Only when I got married that Fiona read children's stories to me every other night in bed. So I would catch. She tried to catch up with me with children's stories. But no, there was no. And it was funny because I was talking to Fiona this morning, and we were talking about my initial fear of going to, like, for a job at the job centre or something, the doctors, and you had to fill forms in. And they always started with your Christian name and surname. I couldn't tell which was what. I didn't know what a Christian name was or a surname. And every time I did, so that would put me into fight or flight, because that's the first question you get asked filling a form out. And I couldn't move on with the form after that. I panicked.
Frankie, this is really helpful, because what I'm trying to do with this conversation is to help us all think about the long-term consequences of children's experiences in school, in part because they're underpinned by our stress system, by our biology. And your story is really clear. You start in primary school with a teacher who makes you feel humiliated at your capacity to read, and then that has a long-term impact, so that you're not really reading until you're in your 30s and you're married.
Yeah. Yep.
That's not too strong a description, is it?
No, it's very accurate.
Okay, tell us about other things in primary school. Tell us about the biscuits, and tell us other things that helped to bring alive how you coped with the fear of primary.
The biscuit was, Fiona now tells me the biscuit was ingenious. You know, it was, I would steal two tea biscuits from the cupboard before leaving the house, and I would keep them in my pocket, and I would get into the school and I would crush them up my mouth, and it would be about 3 minutes before the bell would ring. I would take a drink out of the water fountain and hold the water in the crushed up biscuits until we got to the catechism again, and then I would vomit that all over the table. And the teacher would send me out to help the Johnny. And so that got me out of the class. So that was ongoing. I did that quite a lot to get out of the class. And the Johnny became my safety net. He was absolutely fantastic. Yeah. You know, I mean, I know children say that all the time, that the Johnny's the best teacher. And he was. He certainly was. Yeah.
And Frankie, how old were you when you devised that very creative strategy?
Probably about 6 or 7.
And how long do you use it for?
I couldn't put a time on it, but for me, it feels as if I used it every day until I get out of that class. So maybe about a year I would use that.
It really is ingenious. Can I just pause for a moment and, Emily, bring you back in? What does it feel like as a nurture teacher hearing Frankie's experience for the first time?
It's really hard to hear, you know, how he was feeling at such a young age and how he was blamed for his own development. You know, bluebells in my garden have only just started to come out and bloom. And normally I'd expect them in April, but because of the environmental conditions, that hasn't been possible. So if we apply that same knowledge and understanding to children, rather than blaming Frankie for his own development, we need to be looking at those environmental conditions that allow children to flourish. And unlike bluebells, children have got nervous systems. They've got these experiences being hardwired into their memories. They've got emotions. And so that adds another layer of complexities. But I think that's genius, Frankie, that you developed that strategy to try and, I guess, protect yourself from those unpleasant experiences you were having in the classroom.
It is genius. It's also awful. It's because I just want us to keep thinking about the things that happened for children in Scotland not all that long ago, and that the adults who were in charge of the garden, to use your analogy, Emily, that they didn't know or they didn't see or they didn't know they were supposed to care about. if we can face up to that, if we can use fierce curiosity to look at the distress that adults cause to children, we can reflect on our power. So, Frankie, what else happened to you in primary school that you can tell us stories about so that people remember what it was like not all that long ago and in your lifetime? What else happened in primary school?
Well, primary school, my memory of the education being in a classroom is totally blank. I don't have any memory of being in another classroom. I have great memories of working with the janitor, you know, in the evenings in the school for the ran wee groups for the Cubs and the Scouts, and I would get in and help them to clean up. And my aunt was a cleaner in the school. I would get in and help her. And during the summer holidays, I would go in and help the janitor wash all the windows, because the janitor's job was to do all of that during the holidays. And I would go into the boiler room. And I have to say, I mean, it sounds quite ludicrous, but the boiler room was a frightfully safe place for me. Because I can remember it to this day, pushing a big, heavy, heavy door, and it was two furnaces. And the minute you open the door, you get hit with a blast of heat and a smell and a sawdust to absorb the oil on the floor. But there was a respect, a fearful respect of the noise, and I felt safe within that place. And I stayed there, pretending I was doing tidying up and checking the gauges for the oil when it was going to run low for the heating system in the school. I mean, I was only about 9 or 10 when I was doing that. And the janitor actually served another school, which I went to as well. That was coal burning. And I would help with the belts to clear the coal off the belts. So I had a fantastic time with the janitor. And I gave out the milk, the wee carts, triangle cartons of milk. So, yeah, and I sat in his office and had my lunch. So, yeah, that part of the primary school was delightful. But the fear was still lay underneath that, yeah.
So you almost had an apprenticeship at the age of 8.
Yeah.
About how to run a school and how to run machines.
Yeah.
But the academic insights were not what you were taking from school.
Nothing came, you know, and the sad reality is, to my mom and dad, I couldn't even go to them and talk to them, because in those days, your mom and dad trusted the schools, trusted the teachers, the police, all of the people with authority. Parents were terrified of them as well. So it wasn't just me who was terrified. My mum and dad would have obeyed the rules and regulations of the education system. And they'd say, oh, you must be doing something wrong if the teachers are treating you that way. Because that's what happened at high school. I didn't tell my mum and dad half of what went on at high school, because I would get the blame of it. So I didn't feel safe at home either. And this is not to cast blame. This shows you how far behind we were then. We really need to, what Suzanne said, you... fierce curiosity. We need to ask these questions. We need to feel safe, or get our children to feel safe going to school or going anywhere. And parents have to take that empowerment into their own hands as well. Yeah.
And Frankie, isn't it interesting that when you say feel safe, you mean an individual has to feel emotionally safe in their body? Yeah. It isn't for the grown-ups to simply decide that that this school is safe and will not catch on fire when you open the boilers.
Yeah.
You have to feel emotionally safe for that to translate into your body. That really is what you mean, isn't
it? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Brilliant. Emily, can I bring you back in? If you had had a child who was struggling in some of the ways it sounds like Frankie was struggling, what might you do to support that child in today's world at Lindburn Primary who thinks about these stress reactions and the underlying biology?
So really, we would think about stripping back what it is that is triggering the stress within the child. We would look at how we could promote feelings of comfort. That might be through giving them a little object that smells nice, or a teddy, something comforting that helps to promote those feelings of emotional safety. It might be looking to chunk their day down so they get different experiences in different parts of the school. That's not the boiler room, but that is designed to support the emotional regulation of child, we would look at the relationships that need to be put in place to support the child, whether that's with the nurture teacher, myself, another adult in the school. We would also get the parents' views and speak with the parents and see what support they might need to help the child. That there's lots of things that we can do to make their day a little bit easier, whether that's a slice of toast at breakfast or something a little bit more long-term and substantial to develop their emotional literacy. Because these big emotions, they are their whole body experiences. So that terror that you experience, Frankie, it lives within our biology, it lives within our body. Yeah. and gets re-triggered at various moments in our life.
Absolutely, yeah.
So if that's your primary experience, Frankie, and you're not in a school system or a historical time period that thinks about doing the sorts of things that Emily is describing, that's the basis and the expectations you've gained of school as you go into secondary school.
Yeah.
You're scared. Your stress system is heightened. That will be impacting your ability to manage your emotions, which will look like behavior. You won't trust people terribly well. And you're about to leave the janitor with whom you do feel safe.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. So now you get to secondary school. Tell us, please, what happens next in your life.
To keep it short, I still couldn't read. And I couldn't write, so I was instantly put into what they called a remedial class. And that class was called, for the other school pupils, called it the plasticine class, because you got basic stuff. I mean, I can't even remember how basic it was, but I remember we got plaster of Paris and we had to make things out of clay, etc. And it was... Yeah, that was very humiliating because everyone in the class was the same, you know. So there was no such thing as exams for me. Well, I got exams, but there was no choosing subjects. And I was so bad, I got a report card sent home after first year and it said on it, least said, sooner mended. So, and he recommended that I repeat first year. And my mum and dad believed that was right. Again, my mum and dad were afraid or trusted the system. And I repeated first year. And it's quite funny because I got that same teacher again for English and he still couldn't teach me. So I skipped second year and went straight into third year. So I had no second year schooling at all. So I was two first years and then a third. And I remember in my history class, the teacher said, because in those days, you were asked to stand up when your name got called and they were going to read out your results for your exam. So I, Frankie Larkin, so I stood up and he said, 1 out of 100. Now, I had a defence mechanism. I had to be the funny guy. I had to come back with an answer because I was too humiliated to actually stand and take that in front of a class. So I said, oh, sir, I said, what was the one for? And he says, for spelling your name properly. And that was it. So that was the exams. That was, you know, all of my exams, except for, I have to say, like woodwork, metalwork. I loved woodwork, metalwork.
Yeah.
And even to this day, and there's a story behind that as well. So, Emily, you said about, you know, what would you give the child something to smell? If you'd have given me a hammer and nails and a saw, you'd have seen a smile on my face all day long at any time I was at school. So, and then I had a teacher who allowed me to bring up my motorbike and strip the engine down. But that turned pear-shaped as well because he lost it one day with me and punched me in the face. So there was no trust with any of the teachers whatsoever.
Frankie, can I just pick you up there? So because lots of people won't really believe you and they'll think maybe you just exaggerated there.
Yeah.
Because what's happening is that is a physical punishment is about to descend in your life.
Yeah.
So let's just start there. When you say, so first of all, for any international listeners, children move on to secondary school at the age of 11 or 12. So if we think of Frankie as a 12-year-old and 13-year-old and 14-year-old when he's describing this period, Right. Frankie, do you really mean a teacher punched you in the face? What do you mean?
Yeah. So I suppose that would probably be equivalent to being in repeating first year. He was quite keen with like motorbikes, engines, etc. And he had a couple of go-karts. And I thought it was an art teacher, and I thought I was his favourite. So he let me leave the class because I couldn't draw. And I was getting tinkering about with the go-karts or my motorbike. And this morning, I don't know what kind of mood he was in, but I was turning around, talking to someone behind me. And he said, everyone face the front. So I thought because I was his favourite, I didn't have to face the front. And as I turned around to face the front, I was met with a fist. Yeah, yeah. And that was once I had physical punishment prior to that.
Okay, so if we just keep thinking, there was a time in Scotland not that long ago when teachers punched 12-year-olds in the face.
Yeah.
Okay. Pause to let us think about that, because now that sounds unimaginable. But in your day, it was pretty normal.
Yeah.
Tell us what other sorts of physical punishment and belting happened for you, Frankie, for people who may not remember what it was like in the 60s.
Well, I suppose the ones that stand out the most, because they were in front of the full class or the full assembly, there was two occasions. One, again, I couldn't get an answer right. The teacher asked me a question and I didn't know the answer. So he told me to come out to the front of the class and kneel down on the floor. And he hit me over the head with a big, huge dictionary. And it hit me so hard that a bit through the bit of my tongue. That was very humiliating. And that wasn't even counting the belt. And then one day in the assembly, now, I wasn't innocent, far from it. I would avoid classrooms as much as I possibly could. And then in the assembly, I would stand at the back. And this particular day, four of us decided to disappear, sneak out. And I had caught my finger in a cement mixer prior to that, and it had 7 stitches and it was bandaged up. So I couldn't take the belt on my right hand. And we all disappeared and ran away, but we got caught. So they wanted to make an example of us. So they wanted to belt us in front of the full assembly. So they put us in a line, and everyone, there were 3 in front of me, they got one of the belt each. And then it came to me and they said, put your hands up. And I put one hand up and they said, no, your other hand is a cancer. I said, because I've got stitches in that. And the hospital said, I've not to take the belt because it could burst the stitches. He says, well, you'll get 2 of the belt then on the one hand. I says, no, I'm not. I'm taking one. The other 3 got one. I'm taking one. And because I was cheeky, then he grabbed me by the scruff of the neck and ran me down off my feet, down into a cupboard, down out the road of the assembly. Fortunately enough, that my brother and another 2 people saw this, and they came running after to make sure that I was okay and I was safe. You know, so he kind of declined and given me the other start and kind of let me go.
I very much appreciate you sharing these stories so publicly, because it helps us to think seriously, if I just keep repeating myself, about the things that it used to be normal to do to children. Yeah. Now, you've used the word belt. For international listeners, they may have no idea what it means in Scotland to belt a child. And you're describing putting up your hands. Can you tell us what belting was like in your day and what was used and what it felt like? And
it depended on the teacher. Okay. Some had a 2-tongue belt and some had a 3-tongue belt. And it was a leather strap. It was kept inside. A lot of them kept them inside their jackets. So it was handy. And you had to roll up your sleeves and put your 2 hands up. And if it was misjudged, then the strap would come up and leave big welts on your wrist. Yeah.
So the teachers used the tongued leather belt to hit the palms of your hand.
Yeah.
And they might do that for 1 stroke or 2 strokes or how many strokes?
Well, the most I ever had was 5, one after the other. Now, I was a bit stupid because I was told by other school colleagues that if you start to cry, this teacher's quite soft. He'll stop when he sees the tears. However, I didn't cry. And I that day, I didn't deserve the belt. I actually owned up because I was getting bullied. And the bully said, if you don't own up, we're going to give you a kicking. That means give you a doing when you batter me. So it was either that or the whole class was going to get belted because we get caught smoking. So I stupidly put my hand up and said, it was me that was smoking. So he took me outside the class and he gave me five of the belt. Then I started crying. Then he didn't give me any more after that. So I was angry at myself for not crying after the first one. Yeah.
And what did it feel like? So for people who've never had that experience, what does it feel like if you're a 13-year-old and you're getting your hand hit with a leather belt that's designed to cause pain?
Well, very, very sore. And you can't wash it. You can't touch it for the rest of the day. Or even the next day. I mean, it's red and it's got marks on it. Yeah, it's not pleasant.
And how often would you say you got belted, roughly during your secondary years?
Well, I would probably average about 3 times a week. Now, I didn't play truant. A lot of people played truant from school. I was too afraid. So if I had played truant, then I wouldn't have got as much of the belt. I'd have missed it. But I stayed at school and endured three times a week. I mean, I was getting it for, like, even forgetting my PE kit or refusing to do gym. Because in those days, I mean, like every human being, we get embarrassed stripping off our clothes to change into showers and et cetera. And when you say no to that and then, you know, I don't have my clothes with me, my gym clothes, then you got belted right away.
I'm just leaving a pause so that we can think about the idea that adults thought that it was normal for a child who doesn't want to change or who has forgotten their PE kit, who is living in poverty because your family was struggling, Frankie. I'm just giving us time to think about that the adult's normalized response was to hit a child. Yeah. What else did you get hit for, Frankie, just to give us a full picture of that? So for smoking.
Smoking. Yeah. Oh, well, there was one day I didn't have a tie on, my school uniform. And it was, I only had 6 months to go to school. And I'm not going to mention the person's name because he's a very, very well-known person in society. He's now dead. I remember that he pulled me into, he noticed me out the window because I was actually picking up papers, again, helping the janitor at high school. I would pick up papers. And he noticed me out the window and called me in because I didn't have a tie. And he wanted to give me the belt. And I said, I'm not taking the belt. And he said, you haven't got the school uniform. And I said, well, my mum and dad can't afford it. Plus, I've only got 6 months to go. And my mum and dad's not going to buy another school tie for me if I've only got 6 months to go. So he was determined he was going to belt me. Yeah.
These are very terrible stories. I'm pausing as I find a word for it. And they were very normalized. What you're describing happened to hundreds of thousands of children.
Yeah.
In the 60s and 70s in Scotland. You're just able to tell us the story really clearly.
Yeah. The thing is, I'm sorry for interrupting, but the belt was the easiest part of school.
Go on.
The physical belt was the easiest part. It's what the belt represents to people at school. So when you get belted, what you hear and believe is, I'm a waste of space. I'm not worth the bother to teach. I don't have any time for you. You're not recognised in this establishment. So you're actually isolated and ostracised because other students at school who were intellectually and academically clever or could manage the school didn't get the belt. So it's only a minority within schools that get the belt. Well, at my school it was. If you did your work and you brought your gym kit and you wore your tie, which is not complicated for people to do, but it was for me. So it was easy to belt me because I resembled, like, rebellion, if you like. But what it told me was, you're a waste of space. You don't deserve to have an education. So even when I left school, I prayed and I was so delighted when my last day of school came. I danced out the gates. Really, I was so, so pleased. And I thought, I'm free at last. Until I started to look for work. And my passion was to be a motor mechanic. And I walked everywhere, from every garage where I lived for miles to get a job. And the first question they asked me, what certificates do you have? What education do you have? So it came back instantly to bite me.
Ricky, it's such a powerful story. It tells us why we need to think about these things, because children carry the consequences. And you've told us that the belting started when you hit secondary school around about 11 or 12. There are lots of stories of five-year-olds in Scotland being belted.
Yeah.
So, Emily, can I bring it back to you? Can I ask again my earlier question? As a teacher in Scotland, what did it feel like to hear Frankie tell that story of himself as a child?
Do you know, I feel sick hearing some of what you've experienced at the hands of the adults, the people that were supposed to be there to care for you. And, you know, my thoughts and feelings about this are about school cultures. You know, when you are a newly qualified teacher and you enter into a school, you really adapt and take on a lot of the cultures that schools have. And so for me, it's so difficult to even think or consider that violence and aggression against children was part of the culture. It's really hard to hear. It's really hard to hear. And as you know, as levels of regulation decrease, so does IQ levels. So actually the punishment, the shame, the humiliation that you were experiencing was also directly impacting your IQ levels and your ability to learn.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the way we treat children matters. That's the key message that Scotland has taken from the science on trauma and attachment and connection and relationships, that we need to keep paying attention to the way adults treat children and the feelings of safety or threat that are prompted within that. As we move toward the end, can I just remind us with a little story of fierce curiosity how this changed? Because now, Frankie, your experience sounds horrific, although it was normalized at the time. We could ask, when did it become illegal to hit children with a belt or a book or a fist? And sometimes people are quite shocked to discover that that didn't happen until 1986. Two mothers in 1976 said to the school systems and their local authority that they did not want their children hit. And the local authority said they had the right to hit their children. So they took their case to the European Court of Human Rights, and it was 1982 before a decision was taken that said parents had a right to refuse to have their children hit and local authorities had to abide by what they wanted. But then the schools had a problem. And as they put it, they were going to need to choose between the children who were allowed to be beaten and the children who were not. And they decided that was not sustainable. And in 1986, the decision was taken that you could not use corporal punishment for children in public schools, that is, in state schools. It remained until the end of the 90s legal to hit children in private schools. So it was 1998, 1999, it was 2003 in Northern Ireland before the legal decision was taken that you could not hit children. That's really stunning to think that had those two mothers not been brave enough to take on the school system, that perhaps we would still think that it's normal to hit children. And as I really wind this up and bring us to the end, it lets us start to think about how ideas of normalization change and what goes unseen in the midst of things that are normalized. So can I close with two other questions? Emily, what would you like teachers to take away from this conversation that will have been hard for many of them to hear? What do you hope your colleagues take from this conversation?
I hope there is that understanding about how relationships matter. You know, one way or another, we are wiring these experiences into the brains and bodies of children, whether that's negative or positive. And, you know, what we should really be aiming to do is showering our children with love to help them buffer against the adversities that they experience in modern day life.
The word love is a very strong one, especially in an educational setting. Some people will really be thinking about the fact you've chosen that word. Thank you. Frankie, when you tell your story, you want to end with a really important point, which is that it is possible to heal even from the kind of abuse that you experienced. Tell us about why you feel so strongly about that, please.
Yeah, I'll try to say it as short as I can, Suzanne. It goes back to what Emily was talking about. If we're not emotionally connected, then our rational mind, our neocortex is not going to be connected. We're in fight or flight. So I have to go back. I have to understand backwards while I'm moving forwards in life. You, when I did my regression work on why I was the way I was, why was I so sensitive? Why did I have that emotional need? And when I traced back, I found the answer to that. So in finding that answer, I had a conversation with my mum, not my dad, because my dad died when I was 23, but the conversation with my mum was so liberating because I didn't blame my mum for anything prior to that anyway, but it's very easy to blame those roundabouters or those from the past. It's not about blame. They did their best. My mum and dad did their best. They believed they were doing the right thing. So when my mum explained to me her circumstances when I was in the room, it made absolute sense to me that I was going to experience emotional detachment. It's proximal abandonment. So that liberated me enough to know that, gee whiz, this is not even my anxiety. This is not even my stress. It doesn't belong to me in the beginning, but I've inherited it. So now I can break that link. So I decided then to break the link and go into further education. And I have no regrets at school. I wouldn't want to go through it again. Absolutely not. But I wouldn't change it. But I certainly wouldn't want to go through it again because I'm the person I am today on the back of that. I'm one of the fortunate ones who actually got that insight and I got that conversation from my mum to make sense of, I suppose, my existence, why I had the feeling I didn't have the right to exist. But once that was eliminated and taken off the table, then I flew. I went to college. I did a counselling course and I went on to Glasgow University. So it is possible. Yeah, I'm still a bit slower in processing things because I was labelled dyslexic, but it's not dyslexia. For me, it's not dyslexia. It's that emotional detachment that prevents us, as you said, from learning, having the ability to learn. So that's where it ended up. So
Frankie, I hear you saying that if the adults in your life can listen to the distress you felt as a child and they can help you to make sense of it, and that might include having them say sorry for the part that they unknowingly played in it, that's a key part of healing and that you don't then have to carry the consequences of that early pain.
It's acknowledgement of something went wrong. There was a rupture. And as you say, Suzanne, when you hear that conversation, you know, because I know a lot of people who have experienced similar stuff, and there's still friction between the parents, etc., and it's there with them for the rest of their life. I was fortunate that my mum listened to what I had to say, and she said, "No, you're right." She said, "And I regret now not taking more time to read stories." But my mum's life was made up of practicalities. You know, she had four children to look after. There's no way she could sit down and do read stories constantly to us.
Frankie, it's a really valuable end to your story, if end is the right word, because I think it gives hope that people are not imprisoned in mm-hmm. the childhoods that they had if they have the courage to face up to them. And Emily, if I link that professionally, it gives hope that if we can pay attention now to the places in which we may be unintentionally causing stress and harm to children, we can step out of that rather than discover years down the line the pain that we caused. So I appreciate you both very much coming to have this conversation. I think if we can share these stories of fierce curiosity, then they help us to understand how change has happened from the past, and how if we look more closely today, we will not have children who are carrying the kind of pain that you describe, Frankie. So thank you both so much for being here. And Gary, I'm going to turn it back over to you to tell us, what did that whole conversation sound like to you? And what did you find surprising, Gary? Because you didn't know the stories of either of today's guests.
First of all, thank you both for your honesty and for your expertise, Emily as well. I in my mind, I'm always thinking and reflecting on care for children, for young adults, and for adults. And one thing that came through loud and clear was that before you can have any emotional attachment with anybody, they have to have trust. And if you don't have that trust, then, as we say, the game's a bogey. It's just not going to happen. You know, the interesting thing as well, Suzanne, is that we're not through the woods here, because we're talking about early to mid-60s for Frankie's story. But yet you can turn on the radio, you can look on the TV news, or you can download a podcast or whatever you get in your news. And even today, we're having discussions about putting children, young adults, young people who are struggling at school to the back of the dinner queue.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Come on.
Gary, that's really important. That for me is the point of fierce curiosity. It's to tell these stories of the past that help us to see the harm that was done that normally the adults in the systems are in denial of because it feels too uncomfortable to look at. And then it's to take that courage and to apply it to today. So we might not have physical abuse that's allowed today, but many people are worrying that we've moved on to emotional abuse, and that we are in as much denial of the emotional consequences of that, of the damaging consequences for children, as people were in the 60s and 70s in denial of the consequences of physical abuse. So we are asking some really serious, very contemporary questions. Are the disciplinary procedures that are in place in schools today harmful? And how does that feel? And how do we talk about it? And what do we do about it? Because the behavior of children has escalated since COVID especially, and I'm using the language that you often see in the press, that words like violence are used regularly. It's true, teachers are more scared. Teachers have a harder time in the classroom. I am not denying at all what happens in schools. What I'm trying to do is to help us to think about how we think about that. And if children's underlying biology is heightened and in a sense of threat, and we don't pay attention to that, then we make things worse. That's the point of listening to Frankie's story and to hearing what Emily does at Lindbergh Primary to pay attention to children's stress. We need to think about this now as much as people needed to think about it in the 1960s when Frankie was 4.
Well, can I thank you again for your time, Suzanne, for sharing fierce curiosity. And I know that we have more stories and we have more fierce curiosity under the guise of My Life with Amazing Strangers on the way in the next couple of weeks. Thank you for your time, Frankie. Lovely to see you. Lovely to hear you. And Emily, you as well. Thank you so much. Dr. Suzanne Zeedijk, we'll talk in a couple of weeks. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, everyone.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Bye.
My Life. Amazing. My Life.
My Life. Amazing. My Life.
That was episode 7 of My Life with Amazing Strangers. In forthcoming episodes, we'll be looking at children's hospital care with Suzanne, and our other co-host, David Wilson-Wynn, will introduce us to the latest developments, the latest thinking, and improvements in dementia care. All that and much, much more from the world of care in the United Kingdom in the podcast series My Life with Amazing Strangers. Until then, take care of others and, importantly, yourself. From me, Gary Robinson, bye-bye.